Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The word of the Buddha. And now the right mindfulness. Here we go. So please be mindful while I'm talking. So the four focuses of mindfulness. I'm going over just the introduction which I gave yesterday at the end of the session yesterday afternoon. The four focuses of mindfulness leading one direction only, to the purification of beings going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana. What are the four? Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, aware of experience, aware of the mind, aware of the mind objects, energized, not with sloth and torpor, knowing the purpose of what you are doing. What are you doing this for? Unmindful. And it's important to know what you're doing and mindful, because even now that they use mindfulness in all sorts of activities, such as mindfully shooting guns. So you know the purpose of what you're doing. That is not a good thing to do. So at least you have restraining the five hindrances. It doesn't mean there's a small point here which many of you probably have noticed. It says restraining the five hindrances. It hasn't overcome them yet. It's weakening the five precepts through that right endeavor, saying no to things, and through letting go of stuff, and through keeping precepts. That is where the hindrances get lessened. They get... You start to wake up, you're not so restless, you don't want so much because you're content. All of those things starts to lessen the strength of the five hindrances. You're restraining them. And then that's enough to be able to do these practices. So of those four, the mindfulness of the body, of the experience, the mind and the mind objects, we start with the body. How are you aware of the body? And in the Buddha's description of mindfulness of the body, it goes back over to the mindfulness of the breath again. How are you aware of the body? You go to a quiet, secluded place, like Jhana Grove. Sit down comfortably. It does not say sitting down on a bed of nails or on broken glass or in the middle of an ant pile just to test how tough you are. You don't do things like that in a comfortable place, and you sit down comfortably and you give priority to establishing mindfulness. Now, that is a translation there, give priority to establishing mindfulness, which solved a lot of problems for me, and it's an accurate translation because the Pali said putting mindfulness in front. Now, what it means in mindfulness in front, it doesn't mean in front of your nose, because you may be watching some other object of meditation. In front of what? But many people have assumed it means in front of you, and so they start putting mindfulness on the tip of their nose. Oh, my goodness. Because I was never taught that, thank goodness. And it was only after teaching many years when I went to visit Malaysia. And when I went to visit Malaysia, all the people there were complaining about samadhi headache, meditation headache. And I was stunned. I meditate to overcome headaches, not to get them. And they were saying, meditation headache. So what on earth have you been doing? It's just like that story this morning about the old monks don't lie. They heard the instructions, but they hadn't understood them. Because what they were doing, they were focusing on the tip of their nose. And they're getting headaches. And it doesn't take long to understand why. I have to do this little demonstration every time I do a meditation retreat. I have to take off my glasses so you can see my eyes, especially my eyeballs, really clearly. I'm not going to close my eyes, but now I'm going to watch the breath at the tip of my nose. Have a look at what my eyes do when I start to watch the breath at the tip of my nose. My eyes go crossed. And if I stay like this for even not half an hour, for 10 minutes, I get some mighty headache across here. Okay, we'll do it again. Okay, I'll do it again. This is for the camera. Oh, come on, I'll do this. I'm getting some mighty headache myself. This is paparazzi headache. But what it really was is underneath your eyelids, when you were meditating, you were focusing on the tip of your nose. And automatically, you're not conscious of it, subconsciously, your eyes tend to go where your mind puts its attention. And so in this particular case, you're focusing so hard on the tip of the nose, underneath the eyelids, the eyes were going there as well. People were getting headaches, tension headaches across here. And it doesn't mean that. When it says put it in front, it doesn't actually say in front of you. Put it in front means top of the list. First thing to do. It actually, the word in English is priorities. You prioritize it. You make it the number one of the things to do. Mindfulness first. Because if you don't have a little bit of mindfulness, you can't watch your breath. And I've been teaching a long time now, and I've noticed that sometimes people are just so impatient. So they just want to go into jhana straight away. All this watching their breath, even just, you know, piezometers. Oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, get real. And so what they really want, they want to go straight ahead into the breathing. They're not ready. So when they stay, okay, watch the breath, breathe in and out. They can do that for 3 or 4 breaths, maybe 10 if they really put some effort onto it. Really screw up their mind, 15 breaths, but they can't hold it. They're not ready to watch the breath. You have to do things like just sit down comfortably, secluded place, just relax, and then you establish mindfulness. When mindfulness is strong enough, then you can watch the breath and it's no problem at all. Not just one breath, but many breaths, breath after breath after breath, because you're peaceful, you're aware. And it's not just, you know, any old mindfulness. It has to be strong enough mindfulness so you can actually see the breath and it interests you. That's going back to what I was saying about the different intensities of mindfulness. Ordinary mindfulness, when you're having a cup of tea and just talking to somebody, but then hopefully you've experienced some moments when your mind is really clear and just you can actually taste the tea. And you can actually feel the wind. You're actually alive. Your mindfulness is just like the story of walking up the hill. You can see more. You can feel more. Your senses are just receiving more information. And you're going slower. You've got more energy. And it's the other lovely thing is you get more happiness. Natural happiness just because you're going slowly. And you're waking up. So this is what you have to do to start off with. Give priority to establishing mindfulness. Then mindful you breathe in, mindful you breathe out. Should be pretty easy. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you are aware that they are short. Now, first of all here, that some people say, oh, you've got to do a short in-breath first of all, and then a short out-breath, and then you do a long in-breath and long out-breath, and you've got to mess around, seeing if you can extend the breath to be your world record personal best long breath, and just the shortest breath ever, which is totally crazy. You don't control the breath. It's long or it's short, whichever it happens to be, you just know that much. You don't do, okay, stage one, long breath, stage two, short breath. It's just, is your breath long or short? That's all. And of course, that answers a question that most of the time, my breath isn't long, it's not short, it's sort of in the middle somewhere. Does that mean I'm not following the mindfulness of the breathing method? Because it doesn't mention in the middle. It just says, long breath, you know it's long. Short breath, you know it's short. What about the middle breath? What about, you know, the two-thirds breath? You know, not sort of really long. So all it really means is you just know whether the breath is sort of long, sort of short, and you let the breath do the breathing. Now the next one is when you... Then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. And my goodness, this just starts to, as simple thing as this, starts to cause controversy. Because the word they use in Pali is called kaya. And kaya can mean many things. It's the same as the word body in English. Now, what does a body mean in English? If there are any soldiers here, it's a body of troops. If there's any lawyers, there's a body of evidence. It does mean a physical body as well, but what it means in the same in English, it means just a group, a collection of things. And just because it says the body, it doesn't mean you're aware of the body when you're doing this breath meditation, especially when it says, and that is very clear, where you experience the whole of, they call it the whole of the breath body. So if it's the whole of the body, now I ask you, can you be aware of the whole of your body now? Are you aware of your kidney? Are you aware of your, what's a nice one, which is really weird, your left toe, nail? That's part of your body. He said, no, you can't be aware of the whole of your body. So sometimes it's totally logical. That's why they don't like people like me, too logical. So what it means the whole of the breath, from the beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath. And you know this is the case because it happens naturally anyway, even if you don't, you know, decide to do anything. You're watching your breath go in and out, long or short. You just give it a bit of extra attention, something more than just in and out breath. Well, that's a nice long breath. That's one of the reasons why that great monk Ajahn Gunha I talked about some time ago. Breathe in, sabah. Breathe out, sabah. That is the first and second stages there. To knowing the breath is an in-breath, is long or is it short. That's the same, just that little bit of an extra handle on the breath. So it makes it a little bit more interesting. Is it long, is it short? So that falls into those first two steps. And after a while, you know, when you start watching the breath, you can see from the very beginning of an in-breath, when it first starts. You feel it natural, just feel it right to the end of an in-breath. You don't expel it, it just does it itself. Then the breath goes out. You don't miss any moment of just one breath cycle. That's called the whole of the breath. Or to put it another way, I've got my finger going in front of my eyes. So I've got to do it the other way around because you see things the other way around than I do because you're facing me and I'm facing my finger. So this finger is now going to go from the right to the left, and then the left to the right, it's opposite to me, right to left. So I see it. It's gone to the left, gone to your right, gone to your left, right, left, right. I can see it passing by, see all the breaths. That's just knowing an in-breath and out-breath. The full awareness of the breath, you see it go all the way to your right, see every part of it. You see it stop all the way to your left. See all the parts of it. That's focusing. So that's what it means by the full awareness of the breath. And when you do your walking meditation, it's sama-sama. That's Bahasa. it's really easy. That's one easy Indonesian word to understand. Sama-sama means the same. So it's great, any of you from Hong Kong, they say something you don't understand what it means, you say, oh, sama-sama. Same to you. I hope it's something nice they said. They usually is, because all the nice people come to the to Jada Grove. So anyway, that's called a whole of the breath. It's number 3 of mindfulness of breathing. You learn to experience a whole of the breath as you breathe in and a whole of the breath as you breathe out. When you walk in meditation, you know, you feel the legs start to move and go up. And every part of that movement you can feel. And then the foot goes down onto the ground. The full awareness, every moment of it. And it's not hard. It actually gets really fascinating, enjoyable. I hope you've been walking meditation and feel that it's so wonderful. Just watching your feet move, you're focused, you're inside, you're comfortable, no one's distracting you, and you don't force the walking, you just observe it. It comes in, and it's amazing just how many muscles in your leg have to move just to get one step. It's one of the most complicated actions. That's one of the reasons why, you know, in artificial intelligence and robots, that's one of the hardest things for people to actually get a robot to walk. You know, it's because it is incredibly complex. You know, the kids learn it. You learn it when you were a toddler, and now you take it for granted. But if anyone has things like strokes, and they have to learn how to use those muscles again, oh, it's just they realize how complicated it is. But this is just, you know how to do it. Now you just watch and you observe, and sometimes in awe of how this body learns to walk forward without falling over. So anyway, this is the in-breath. You're experiencing the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. And then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. And this, they call this the Kaya Sankara. It's, you know, it's the will, the body willed. It's the will making itself do something in your body. You just calm it down. And it happens very naturally anyway. The breath calms down. Just as a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brushstroke or a short brushstroke, so too when the in-breath is long, you're aware that it is long. And that is based on the simile. If those of you who've read the Anapanasati Sutta, they say just like a lathe turner knows when they make a long a turn or a short turn. Now, when I was a monk over in northeast Thailand, there was no electricity around, and we had to make our own requisites, things like umbrellas. So we made a lathe. Now, just like they read here, not electric lathe. It was this big piece of bamboo, long piece of bamboo, really sort of put into the ground, very firm. On the end of the bamboo was a string. So when you pull the string down, it would spring back up again. So the bottom of the string was a little treadle, like the old treadles you have used to see on the sewing machines. So you push the treadle down, and the string would go down, and then you'd release it, it would spring back up again. And the string was wound around a piece of wood between two nails, and you would carve it, so you get a lathe. And because, you know, I did that, I lathe umbrellas and stuff when you were a young monk, making all your own stuff, that, you know, you understood the simile. Just as a lathe operator does a big pull or a short pull, they know. But how many of you have used an old-fashioned lathe like that? None of you. So it doesn't really make any sense. So instead of that, I say, you've done some painting. If you haven't done some painting, you probably, you know, you probably intended to paint the ceiling, but most of the paint were on the floor until you decide to get a professional to come and do it. It's much cheaper. You don't waste so much paint. And so a skilled painter is aware they long brushstroke or a short brushstroke. That's all it is.
In the same way, you're aware of your own body, or you're aware of the bodies of others of the same nature as yours. It's just a body, it's just a breath. Or you're quite aware of the nature of both your own and others' bodies. What they're doing here by investigating your body, here's just the breath, exactly how it works, what it does, even just going to this part of the meditation, just the first four stages of Anapanasati. You know, you realize, as you, as me, no one is special. So you are not some sort of anomaly in this world. So you understand others, you understand yourself. And you're aware of, or else you're aware of what causes the arising of the body. This body, what causes it? And the arising and passing away in Anapanasati does not mean just like things coming and going. It's the causes, why they come. And the causes of the body are the four nutriments. And you abide that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. Or you abide contemplating the body's causal nature of both arising and ceasing. And if you go a little bit further down, which is the four nutriments. Oh, my, eh? Where's that gone? It's supposed to be here somewhere. Four nutriments. Hey, that's really supposed to be there. Okay, well, the four nutriments. What keeps the body... Oh, there we go. It's arising and passing away, rise and fall. Yeah, oh, it's the page I'm on now. 40. 40? 40? Arising and passing away, in the brackets, rise and fall. It's the end of the body. Scroll down. Be mindful. Where it says arising and passing away, and in brackets, rise and fall. You got that one? Hey, it doesn't matter. I'll just read it out. The four nutriments is the origination and continuance of this body. With the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. And the four nutriments are? Doesn't matter, it's okay. Because it's only very brief. The food. Obviously you need food to keep going. You need six sense contacts. In other words, experience, will, and consciousnesses to keep this body going. And there we have some interesting stuff about how the body works, because it's not just without food. You can actually live without food for a while, and that includes like water, but sense contacts. Because if ever you've been in a hospital and somebody's got in a coma or in a... they look like they're dead, they're not responding. And a lot of times people, like I was going to say, having had a stroke, sometimes you look at them and they can't respond. But unless you stimulate their senses, in other words, talking to them, sort of holding their hands, stroking them, some stimulation is necessary, otherwise they just die. And this is actually where the sense contact is one of the fuels for this body to survive. So if a person is, in a coma, and that, they're in that state when they can't respond back, they can't move any part of their body, let alone form speech, but they can feel and hear and see, you have to stimulate them, tell them the latest news, just hold their hand, just anything, give them a foot massage, anything which stimulates their senses. Because without that sensory stimulation and contact, they die. It's a food for the brain. And of course, there's the will. And I think you all know of cases where people I've had this myself many times, going to see somebody who's really sick and dying, And then you go into their room and they just they do something and then they die afterwards. As if they're waiting for all of their friends and relations and loved ones to come. And they keep on waiting, and then you may come over from Hong Kong to Perth to see poor old Ajahn Brahm on his last legs. I said, oh, at last you come. And then I go. So that's an exaggeration, but you've seen that happen many times. People will themselves to keep living until the things are just finished. But sometimes people give up the will to live. Because, you know, it's for some people that somebody close to them dies and they just die pretty shortly afterwards. What was that? I was talking about it to someone recently. There was a case in an old people's home. Two man and woman, been married for about 70, 80 years. And, you know, a long time. And they were, you know, so inseparable that they were, you know, adjacent rooms in the old people's home. And sometimes they would just, you know, move in together. And that they found both of them dead together, you know, laying next to each other, both dead. Natural causes. You know, one of them died, and the other one next to them died about an hour later. No sort of unnatural causes. Forget who died first, but one of them died, and the other one, you know, obviously felt that their partner had died and just let go and and died with them. Excuse me, I'm just dying. I was okay. It was a false alarm. But this is just, you know, how it happens. So the will is important. It can keep you going for a few more days, or you can just give up and it just goes. And the last day is consciousness. You need some consciousness inside of you. And that's the four nutriments. And that's, and that's where it was saying the mindfulness of the body. That's going to go back up again now. Or else mindfulness just, it's both of you others. Are you aware of what causes the arising of the body? And you're aware this body will cease when these four causes or one of them disappears? Or by contemplating the body's cause and nature of both arising and ceasing? It's impermanence. It comes from causes. It's not essential. Whilst mindful, it's just a body. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. So this is just your body. It's not yours. So if the body doesn't belong to you, who does it belong to? The government of Hong Kong? No, it belongs to nature. Always like that, because the body belongs to nature. You know, you borrow it for a purpose, but when nature decides it's going to get sick, you get sick. When nature decides, you know, you get tired, it gets tired. When nature decides you die, you die. So you can't argue with nature. So even though, I think you've heard me say this, that it's coming onto the range retreat. And for those of you at the ceremony on Sunday, you know, you will hear me say, I say all the time, that when, if you really are a good disciple of the Sangha here, especially of me, please don't be selfish. Don't die during the rains retreat. We have 3 months where we can live nice and peacefully. And yet somebody does it every year. They don't consider the monks. So they die and have to come out to do their funeral service for them, and all the other monks have to be bothered as well. So I tell people, you know, die at a proper time. Be respectful. So if you want to die, there's still a few more days to go. You can die, no problem. But, you know, once the range retreat starts, we're on retreat, the monks, you know, you don't want to disturb them. Make sure they have lots of time to meditate peacefully. So after the range retreat is finished in October, you can die whenever you want. But of course, you can't do that, can you? When it's time to die, you just die. Have you ever noticed that sometimes it's some of the most inconvenient times when people die? You know, and you don't get all your jobs and stuff finished. You just die. Nature is just so sort of insensitive to the needs of your family. So anyway, there we go. So that's one way of your mindful of the body. It's independent, not clinging to anything in the world, especially with bodies. The four postures. When walking, you are aware in the present, I am walking. When standing, sitting or lying down, you're aware in the present moment that I'm lying down. It's like present moment awareness and using your posture. You maintain present moment awareness however your body is disposed. Now, it's not just those four postures. You know, sometimes there is somewhere in between, such as you're laying back against the wall. Are you sitting or are you lying down? You're practicing middle way. It's somewhere in between. So it's not just four postures, they just anything in between is fine too. And this way you are aware of your own body, the bodies of others, the same nature of yours. You abide aware of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware again of what causes the arising of the body. This is the same reason why you do these things, so you can understand what a body is, how it comes about, how it will cease and disappear. Nothing to do with you, it's just mindfulness is the body, impermanent suffering and not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. That's established, that's impermanent. It's a pain. That comes up later on when we talk about the deep samadhis. You know, the body's always an ache, there's always something itching or aching or thirsty or hungry. You want to go to the toilet, you go to the toilet and then you want to drink some water and then you have to go to the toilet again. You know, you've got too much water inside body, you haven't got enough. Come, make up your mind. And then, so it's always bothering you. Even at night time, when you get to my age, sometimes you have to get up in the middle of the night and go to the loo. When you're meditating, you're really getting sort of into deep meditation, then you burp. And that's not the real letting go. But what happens is you get so peaceful and still in meditation, the body vanishes. Ah, that's such bliss. No heat, no cold, no tiredness. Free. So that's why they say the body's a pain. So that's why it's permanent suffering, and it's not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. Because, you know, I used to be fit and strong and handsome. Now look at me. Which is the real me? If you say I'm still handsome, I think you need to go and see a psychologist. And get your prescription glasses changed. So, full comprehension of the purpose. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. And this is an interesting part of mindfulness. It's not just being aware. It's, you know, what's the purpose of this? Why are you talking? Why are you eating? Why are you sleeping? Now, why are you just having a glass of water? Why are you sitting on the toilet? And so what's the purpose of this? And it's amazing. When you understand the purpose of what you're doing, you become far more efficient. You know, if the purpose of going onto a toilet is, you know, to just evacuate whatever you need to evacuate, you know, you don't force it. You just, you know, relax and let things go with the flow instead of forcing things. Now, even going to the toilet, okay, it's a bit gross, but it is true that you can see a person's nature. How they go to the loo is very often how they live their life. I want it out now. Busy person. You know, I've got a talk to come to. Now, come on. And then you end up with hemorrhoids. Or, you know, you try and control things. You can't control these things. It's nature. Body belongs to nature. So let nature look after it. So that means that, you know, you understand the purpose of this and what you're walking for. And sometimes you're walking for walking meditation, being mindful. Sometimes you're walking for some exercise and just get the body sort of going. What are you doing it for? And that means that full comprehension when going forward, returning, when looking ahead, looking away, when flexing, extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things, you're acting full comprehension of the purpose of eating. Well, what do you eat for? Is it for fun? Is it because there's a really good cook, you know, in this place? But even if there is, doesn't matter how much a good cook it is, if you eat too much, it doesn't taste good. The taste tends to sort of fade after a while. And also, the feeling in the tummy starts to get worse after a while, eating too much. So the purpose of eating, enjoying the food is important, as I mentioned earlier, that you have to enjoy the food, otherwise you just don't digest it. Because I was, you know what this one monk did over in this monastery in the north of England? And he decided for the rains retreat, let's be tough and simple, really frugal, real monks. So he had a bucket, you know, those 10-litre, 11-litre buckets, you know, used for washing stuff. A 10-litre bucket, and whatever food was left over from today, he put into the bucket and put in the refrigerator. And the following morning, he'd take the bucket out of leftovers, warm it up, and then whatever else food was offered or cooked that day went in top of the bucket. He had his big spoon, stirred it all up, and then passed it down the line. People could have as much as they want. And what was left over went in the refrigerator for the next day. I mean, that's really fruit, but it all gets mixed up inside anyway, mixing up outside. And that means that nothing was lost. You know, everything, they didn't have to worry about, you know, all of the stuff having to be sent to the tip or be composted, because the best compost bin is, you know, your tummy. So he did that for 3 months. Imagine that every day, the bucket comes down the line, stirred all up. You've got today's food, a tiny little bit going today, and what was yesterday, you can still remember that. And you have as much as you want in your bowl, and you eat that. Only one meal a day in that monastery. You know what happened after the retreat was finished? Half the monks disrobed, the other ones left. They had enough. That monk, I'm telling monk stories now, it's good fun. That monk, I can't say who he is, he's still a monk, a very nice monk, but really ascetic, overly ascetic. Because when I first visited England, you know, travelling from Thailand, it's the middle of the winter, and it was minus 26 degrees centigrade outside. It's really cold. And, you know, as I say over there, I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, but I was used to getting up at 3, you know, from Thailand. So I would get up at 3 o'clock, you know, and just, you wake up that time, it's a habit. And then, you know, I got up and I must have a nice shower. It's a bit cold, you know, clean my body. And I went in the shower and there was somebody in the next cubicle to me. And as they were in the shower next cubicle, they started, like, singing. That's what it sounded like. I'm making a really weird noise. And I was really sort of, never heard anything like that. I thought they were doing some chant or some magic sort of incantation. And then, you know, when we sort of came out, I was drying myself and thought of this monk. Is that you in there? It was the only other person in there, you know, in the shower cubicles. And he said, yeah. He said, you were singing. He said, no, I wasn't singing. I determined to have cold showers. That's what happens. You have cold showers. He was really overly ascetic, that monk, but very good fun. Nice guy.
Where are we? So the full awareness of the purpose. You know, you're in the shower, not to freeze yourself, but it's there to, you know, clean your body. And so full comprehension when eating, drinking, defecating, urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. Now, why do you keep silence? Anyone keep silent? No, you keep silent a lot of the time. You're very good. But, you know, why are you doing it? Why are you talking? So you have full awareness. Now, and the talking is sometimes, I shouldn't say this, but it's necessary. A little bit of bonding, a bit of kindness, and a little bit of joy coming up, because you go on some retreats and no one talks at all. Absolutely no talking. And it's like being at school or being in a prison or being in a military camp. And people are quiet, but they're so tense. And there's no joy in there at all. And sometimes you look at someone and you don't smile. And you try and smile. Bad. Stop smiling. This is a serious retreat. No, I'm not going to do it with your camera. Talking has a purpose. Keeping silent has a purpose. Know the right time. Because there was a time when there's a group of monks in the rains retreat, they made a vow that they're not going to speak at all, a vow of silence. And the lay people, they've come to the temple, you know, looking for some answers to problems, meditation instructions, a talk, and they never got anything. The monks were silent. And so they complained to the Buddha, and the Buddha made it a rule. You can't keep a vow of silence for, you know, such a long time. You know, you have your duties, responsibilities. That's not noble silence, that's stupid silence. It's best, you know, to just restrain the speech, not speak too much, but not just not speak at all. So anyway, that's the act of purpose. Understand what these things are for. In this way, you're aware of your own body, the bodies of others, the same nature as yours, or you abide aware of both your own and others' bodies, or you else abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments. The body will cease when the nutriments run out. And you abide contemplating the body's course of nature, both arising and ceasing. Or mindful, it's just a body, that's all. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, and a permanent essence. It's established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is another way you are mindful of the body, or the bodily parts. You review your body from head to toe, bounded by skin, as made up of many kinds of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs. And sometimes you go through the whole list. I don't know why monks want to go through this list. And they especially stop when you get to things like snot, oil of the joints. There's something sickening, quite frankly. So blood and bones, tissues and organs, just as though there were a shopping bag with many kind of groceries, such as bread and potatoes, fruit and vegetables. And they say in the original simile, just like a bag with many types of rice. And of course that would work in India and Thailand, but it don't work at all in Australia when people don't just eat different types of rice, they eat bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables. So just as though there were a full shopping bag with many kinds of groceries, such as bread, potato, fruit and vegetables, so too you review the same body as full of many parts. Thus, in this body there are hairs, bones, shit and urine. I just put those last two in there to wake people up. That is another way that you are mindful of the body. Or elements. You review your body by way of elements. Thus, in this body there are the earth element, water, fire and air element. That's another way you are mindful of the body. The nine charnel ground contemplations. And again, some people really get into this, some weird stuff, I don't know why. But, you know, we would go to the
the autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital. Did I tell you about the autopsy room the first night? Wow, it was really good in those days. There, 40 years ago, that monks, you know, we could go anywhere. And so even though there's a big sign, you know, only sort of officials allowed, but, you know, monks, we could walk into the autopsy rooms and see bodies taken apart. And this, I would never forget this. I went into the autopsy room, the lecture theatre, first of all. You know, and there was an autopsy coming in maybe half an hour. I was there early, and I was just, you know, got a nice seat. And I looked up in the high, you know, the windows, just like here, but the windows had a windowsill. And the bleachers, you know, the graded seating so the students could observe the autopsy went up. And I looked, and that's not a flower pot up there. And I looked, and it was like a plate with a human head on it. And I thought, oh, this must be a fake. But I went in there and picked it up. It was actually a real one. It was something like out of a monster movie. But, you know, instead of having a flower pot, you know, in the sunshine as decoration, they put a human head on there. That was really weird. It's just a head, that's all. They didn't need it anymore. It's just a spare one. I think it was a warning in case any of the students talked back at the doctor, the coroner. So anyway, so you see a body thrown aside in the charnel ground, up to 3 days old, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. You reflect that your body is of the same nature. It may become like that. Or just the body in various parts of decay. But, you know, it's very hard to see a real body, you know, which hasn't been nothing done with it these days. Although somebody said there is, because I went past a TV in the, where was it? But anyway, they have, is it National Crime Scene Investigations or something? Where apparently it's really popular, many TV shows, because there's a few people get inspired to become forensic scientists. You know, when they find a dead body somewhere, and then the scientists, the doctors, they, you know, take it all apart and they find a little bit of something in here, a little bit of something in there, which is the clues to find out who did it. What was it, National Crime Investigation? CSI. Oh, what's that? Crime and Time Investigation, yeah. Apparently it's very popular, but when I was young, you know, you just couldn't see any dead bodies. As soon as you saw any dead body, they were just, you know, covered over with a white cloth. But nowadays, you can see everything. They take all the bones apart and see the livers and stuff. But anyway, that... Oops. But that was actually just to try and find out that, you know, these are the same as you. You know, we're just bodies. I still remember the open cremations we used to do. And sometimes some visitors, especially people like doing voluntary service overseas or the Peace Corps. I remember several of them come up and touch the body, and they never touched a dead body before. And it was really a wonderful experience. Scary. Come and touch it. You feel it. It's a dead body. It's cold. And especially if it's someone of your age. And that's really, you know, and your gender, that really sort of hits home hard. You see someone exactly the same age as you, and the same gender, and you look at them, and they're dead there, and you can feel them and touch them. And it brings it home to you. That could be you. So what that does, it's this way, you're aware of your own body, you're aware the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, or you're aware of both your own and others' bodies. Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body. You're aware that the body is the nature to cease, or you abide contemplating the body's causal nature and ceasing nature. Or else, mindful, it's just a body, it's your vehicle for this life, you look after it. But you realize in the end, nature's going to take it back. Impermanent, suffering, are not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. I remember when I was a kid, you had these lakes, these boating lakes. And you know, you pay some money, you hire the boat for an hour, and you know, you had the signs on the boat. Now, number 22, your time is up, come in. Do they still have those? But some of you remember them? Yeah, because anyway, there was this lake would have these boating for recreation, and the operator was shouting out, boat number 99, come in, your time is up. And it didn't come in, so shouted even louder, boat number 99, your time is up, it's time to come in. Still didn't do anything. And then the owner said, we don't have a number 99, we only have up to 70 boats. Oh, boat number 66,
you've overturned. She wants some help. Or else you're, what am I doing here? Oh yeah, the bones and stuff. My view is just a body, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not permanent essence. It's established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom. Essential for liberation, you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That's another way you are mindful of the body. When mindfulness benefits and mindfulness of the body, this is cool. When mindfulness of the body has been repeatedly practiced and developed, these 10 benefits may be expected. You overcome delight and discontent. Body doesn't feel such good today, but it's only your body. Doesn't matter. You know, in a sense, it's just body. Don't worry too much about it. Fix itself. You overcome fear and dread, especially about being attacked or being injured, or when the doctor comes and says, this is going to hurt. Is there any doctors or nurses? Don't ever say that, please. Has that happened to you? I remember just stepping on a nail, a rusty nail too, in Thailand, and went halfway through my foot. It didn't hurt. I just went through. I thought, oh, okay, take it out. And then the monk with me, he said, oh, that's terrible. And as soon as he said that, it really hurt. If he'd have kept his mouth shut, I'd have been fine. Has that happened to you? That's happened to me, it's just weird. But anyway, this, you overcome fear and dread. You bear cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with flies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind, the sun, and creeping things. You enjoy unwelcome, not just scary things which are danger to your health, but also endure unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful and menacing to it. That is where Ajahn Chah would come along and say, don't worry, you'll either get better or you'll die. It's not going to last. You don't have to worry about anything. Your experience now, this is, you know, you have a natural endurance. It's just body stuff. Isn't to be expected with the body. Number 4. You experience whenever needed, without difficulty, the 4 jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding in this very life. And some of you think, wow, that's a big thing. Straight away from just, you know, having endurance to actually getting the jhanas. You know why? It's because you're not so interested in the body. You can let it go. You're not afraid to let it go. You're just sitting here. It starts to disappear. Oh, you look after yourself. Many of you, when you meditate, you get to whatever stage you've got to before, and then, I can't let go. Why? It's because your 5 senses have to disappear, and the 5 senses are what guards the body. It's like letting all your guards down. When you don't hear anything, someone could come up and they could throttle you. You can't see anything, you can't feel the body. Ooh, it might be a snake coming to wrap its around me. And when I wake up, big python, I'm in a tiger's tummy. I didn't feel anything. Wow. Those things don't happen. So when you can understand the nature of the body and its 5 senses, it's easy to let them go. So you get the 4 jhanas. Now, even more interesting stuff. You wield the various kind of supernormal power. Having been one, you can become many.
So imagine how many jobs you can do at the same time. And you can get a salary for each. You can imagine the tax office figuring out, you know, how to charge you taxes. When you've got about 10 bodies, you've got 10 jobs all at the same time. Wow, that'd be really cool. And about, you know, in your house, you know, doing the cleaning up of your house, you know, 10 people doing it. You split your body up into 10 and just do, you know, one of them is up in there doing the toilets, the other one is making the beds, the other one is just sitting down having a cup of coffee, watching the morning news program. Another one is in the car taking the kids to work. Have you ever wanted to have not just extra hands, but extra bodies? Wouldn't that be cool? Imagine how efficient you... And the other one would be meditating. Wow. So, you appear and vanish. That would be very cool. The police come. You appear and, and vanish. What else do you do? You go unhindered through a wall or through a mountain as though through space. You dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking and as though it were earth. Now, sometimes you do these retreats at the at these resorts, you know, because it's the executive retreats, they call them. Some of you may have been on one of them or two of them. And they're held in 5-star resorts. And it is because it means that people can come with their partners and even their kids. And the hotel staff look after their kids. And some of their partners are a bit afraid of meditation retreats. But they're in a hotel, they can have a nice rest at night and they can eat nice food. But sometimes I find them just in the swimming pool. I say, this is a meditation retreat. We're doing this. Oh, I'm practicing walking on water, but it didn't work this time. But you know, I'll get there. Give me some more time. Anyway. So you're walking on water and without sickness, with earth, on earth, seated cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird and you wield body mastery as far as the Brahma world, flying through the air. And I already mentioned about that monk. Just be careful, one bit of lust, one bit of anger, one bit, and then maybe just in this retreat, you're just flying over the kitchen, you smell lunch, bang, straight down. And that's the fifth psychic powers. And the sixth, with clairaudience, a divine ear, you hear sounds, both heavenly and human, those that are far as well as near. And I remember a case of that in Wat Pa Pong, that particular ability to hear conversations a long way away. Because there was this monk. I first went to Wat Pa Pong, and he'd claimed that he could hear people talking 6 or 7 miles away. He had a really good meditation. And of course, you know, that was, you can't just, you know, are you imagining this? Are you boasting? So the monks had to, you know, just investigate it, test him out. And it was true. You know, they'd have a conversation, you know, in the marketplace about 6 kilometers from the monastery, and he would report exactly what was said. Now imagine if the CIA could get hold of someone like that. You know, you wouldn't have to, Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump just, talking to one another, they'd be able to hear exactly what was being said, even behind closed doors. Imagine the intelligence value of someone who could do that. Private investigators, they'd just be somewhere in the hotel and you can find out what your husband was doing while you're here in this retreat. I've got a really weird mind. But anyway, this monk could do that. But what happened next was interesting, because when people start to develop these psychic powers, if they're not careful, they get into pride and arrogance. And that's what happened with this monk. You know, that one day, I'd only just arrived, so I didn't know too much what was going on. But one day, you know, he was obviously very skilled in meditation, started developing this psychic power. And in the morning, he sat on Ajahn Chah's seat. And, you know, as if he was better than Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah was very skillful with these things. He took him aside, talked to him. And the next morning, there's about 50 or 60 monks in that monastery at that time. And that monk, he bowed to every one of them to ask forgiveness. The most junior monks he would bow to. And then he disappeared. He went. Never saw him again. He obviously still had those powers, but he realized the arrogance, the conceit, the pride which comes with powers. You really have to look out for that one. It destroys people. So that's why we always keep it quiet. And you can read the mind of other persons, having encompassed them with your mind, especially whether the mind is affected by one of the five hindrances or whether it's experiencing jhana. You can read people's minds, but you don't need to be afraid, because, you know, people who develop those abilities are usually very virtuous. And it is like just reading people's private mail or hacking into their computers. Even if you could, it's an immoral, unethical thing to do. So, you know, good monks, good nuns, good people who can do these things, they would resist that. And you can recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births, and many eons of expanding universe, many eons of decaying universes. There was so named of such a family, such an appearance, such was my food, my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared in this other place, and thereto I was so named. As such a family, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. And that's my life term. That's with the aspects and particulars, you recollect many of your past lives. And that's a really interesting thing these days, because many people can do that. And when they remember their past lives, they check it out. I already mentioned a couple of people who can remember their past lives. And they go to those places and the names are there. And there's no way in the world that they could have just guessed that. And it's really quite convincing, especially if you do it, find out who you were before. So they have the old regression therapy. If it's meditation, you get into a deep state of meditation. When you've got your mindfulness is really strong, you're bright, no hindrances, you can't see any hindrances, you're just so blissful, poised. You know that's happening, you can see the floor there and it's incredibly beautiful. That type of mind, peaceful, poised, not restless, hardly any thought in the mind at all, a lot of joy. And then you just ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And if it comes up, it comes up immediately. And you don't force it. It's just the mind. It's just like the well-trained little dog. Go get the paper, woof, woof, woof. And goes and gets the paper, brings it back, woof, woof, woof. And that's like the mind when it's very, very peaceful and very powerful. And so you can ask, you know, what's my earliest memory? If any of you try that, you know, that when you get some memory back, it's always really clear. And it's with the strange thing is the difference between hypnotic regression and through meditation. Meditation is much harder to get to that state, but it's also far clearer and always comes with the knowledge that this is true. If you have an experience like that, you know it's true. It's weird, but you've got absolutely no doubt at all that was you. That was strange. But anyway, then you go and check it out. You know, what was your name? Where do you live? Who was your mum and dad? Whatever. When you actually get all that information, you go and check it. Because now many people just have their birth records, their death records, their marriage records, their work records. Maybe 100 years ago, you know, lived village life, not so organized, no computer databases. You know, you wouldn't know if that was true or not. But now there's so much information held about you and held about your parents, your grandparents, what they did, where they did. And there's many records. It's wonderful if you can actually find those records. And so you see the reincarnation, rebirth. And I think it's important because you always really want to have important, powerful people realize that they've been on this planet before and they're going to come back on this planet again. It's not the case that, you know, you're Mr. Trump, that he's going to be out of here in 10 or 20 years, that he's going to have to come back. I really think that in his next life, Mr. Trump will be reborn in China. It's something, you know, sometimes it's some sort of like a Tony Blair will be reborn in Iraq. Or whatever. There's some sort of like justice somewhere. So you have to find out just what it was like. And you have to take consequences of your actions. So it's not as if that, you know, you're immune. So anyway, you also see like karma. You see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior, superior, fair and ugly, fortunate, unfortunate. One understands how beings are reborn according to their karma. You see the ghosts and the devas and coming and going. And also lastly, by realizing for yourself with direct experience, in this very life you enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind, deliverance of wisdom, you are an enlightened one. So that's what happens. So if you do have a psychic power, please keep it quiet. If you learn how to levitate, do not tell anyone in Indonesia. Otherwise, you will represent Indonesia in the next Olympic Games. When it comes to the high jump, you won't jump, you'll just walk up and you just levitate over the bar. Is that cheating? Is it? Is it against the rules? I don't know. Don't think so. If you're a guy and you want to help Indonesia win the World Cup next time, imagine just how you can jump higher than everyone else to head the ball down with your powers. Is that cheating? I reckon so. So anyway, so don't tell anybody, keep it quiet. But those things, they do exist. Okay, and just one last psychic power. You want a nice psychic power story? No, we won't do psychic power. Okay, because some of you, I've told this story before, there's an Indonesian monk. Remember, what was his name again? Sudama, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, he's passed away now. That's one of the reasons why I say that. That, you know, that he is, because it's really not right to actually let, you know, people know about psychic powers when they're still alive. But this monk, he was Sudama, and I met him, talked to him, and he started off, he wanted to be like a rishi, like a hermit. You know, and just over in the jungles of Java. This was obviously some years ago. And so he just, by himself, he went off into the jungles and just found a nice quiet place and just meditated, sat down in the middle of the jungle. And he said, you know, the story, his English wasn't bad, but, you know, this way you use some words, you had to interpret them. And I'll say exactly what he said, but it made a lot of sense to me exactly what happened. Because he said he was sitting in the jungle, sitting down, no, long way away from anywhere. And he sort of gone inside and he saw he saw a star. He said a star came right towards him. And he said he married that star. And you know, the way he said it, like married it, like, you know, he united with it. And like in marriage, you know, instead of going right inside of it. and blissed out for a long time, when he came out afterwards and opened his eyes, that the forest had changed. It had been damaged. It was not the same, not as pristine as when we entered the meditation. So, you know, he got up and went to the village, and they were surprised that, you know, he was alive, because there had been a huge flood there. And where he was sitting was a couple of meters or 3 meters, 10 meters, I don't know, but very submerged for days. But, you know, in the deep meditation, sajanas, you know, you're invulnerable. Nothing can harm you. You know, literally, it's weird stuff, but this is what happens. And so that, you know, that was almost confirming that I was a very deep state of meditation for days. And from there he ordained as a bhikkhu in Theravada tradition. And I saw him at Wat Bawan, where many of the, you know, Venerable Sri Panyawara, all the Theravada Sangha, Sangha Theravada Indonesia, that was Wat Bawan was where they do their ordinations, or where they used to do their ordinations. And so he was there, and I met him there, a very powerful monk. But there was one of my associates, it was a trusted friend. She was a Thai princess, but, you know, she went to school in England. She was at Chelsea Art School. And so, you know, I didn't see this myself, but I've got no doubt at all it happened, that, you know, she was doing some meditation in Wat Bawan. Every Saturday afternoon, this monk was holding a class. It also tells a story about what happens if people see psychic powers. It scares the life out of them. And so she was meditating very peacefully, and then she felt there's something happening, something wrong. So, you know, she took a peek, opened her eyes, and she saw from this monk rays of light, you know, with eyes, it wasn't sort of fake, really clearly rays of eyes of light going from his eyes into the body of one of the meditators. The monk with laser eyes. This is not Hollywood, not special effect. This was real, actually happening. And instead of being inspired, he got up and left, never went back again. It's scary. And if you see things like that, they say, oh, please, no, sir, I won't be scared. Yes, you will. Anything which is a bit weird and powerful. So the monk with laser eyes. So this, every now and again you see some weird stuff. But, you know, try and keep it quiet until the person has died. Okay, one more? Yeah. This monk is still alive. But I won't tell you who it is. That is a crazy story. But anyway, he's a Thai monk, forest monk, but for some reason he's not really that famous. He should be. I think it's because, you know, many of the monks, we keep his identity quiet. But he would, I think the first time, a couple of times, okay, this time, he was visiting one of the monks over in California. And when he came out of San Francisco Airport, International Airport, and this was after 9/11, Homeland Security, really tough, you know, looking at everybody. And so he came through the customs and the immigration. And this monk, this is a Western monk, a good friend, this Western monk, his bag, you know, that little shoulder bag the monks have, you know, the zip, you know, had caught, and he couldn't open it. And so, you know, he was trying to open the zip, and this Thai monk just came out from the inside area, just arrived, and he took one look at this monk's bag, said, oh, I can help that. And he opened up his robe and took out a pair of pliers and a screwdriver. And the monk said, Where did you get that? He said, I always carry it around. You carry it around on the aircraft? Oh, yeah. And opened up his robe and had this jacket with so many pockets, with a different tool, about three or four knives, screwdrivers, hammers. It was a toolbox he had. And he just goes right through the immigration, right through the customs, right through the so-called security screening, and it never goes beep. And that, the poor Australian, not the American monk, he thought, what are you just being through the customs carrying that? You got like a terrorist wish list on there. But he just goes straight through, in and out, and nothing ever happens. And he's a frequent traveller. That doesn't go through the diplomatic channel. Oh, it just, nothing ever goes beep. Weird, isn't it? But that is a psychic power which is useful. Those eyes. But you don't have to be afraid, because only sort of, you know, very virtuous monks can, or nuns or something, can do things like that. So no terrorist could ever do something like that, because they've just got bad mind. So if you're really sort of high-minded, peaceful, powerful meditation, then maybe you can do that. It's weird, isn't it? Just, and no, that, and it's also strange why he has to carry this. He said, he says it's an idiosyncrasy. He said it's like some karmic. He has to carry a toolkit around with him wherever he goes. It's very heavy. He's got heaps of tools on him all the time, wherever he goes. But, you know, I don't mind going in a car or just in a bus or something, but going on an aircraft, you know, to the United States. Anyway, that's true. I'm not exaggerating. Anyway, it's enough about that. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You know, when I was going through the customs in the United States, you know, they looked at me and they said, because they didn't know what a monk was, and they said, sir, is that a suicide belt under there? And I said, no, it's not a suicide belt, it's only fat. And he said, same thing. Okay. Okay, have a wonderful afternoon. What am I doing? Oh, you'll be away tomorrow afternoon, won't you? Is everyone going tomorrow afternoon to the... just a skeleton crew?
Yeah.
I don't qualify. Do I qualify as a skeleton?
Yeah. Okay.
No, okay. So there won't be a class tomorrow afternoon. There won't be enough for the class now. So just be meditating by oneself. Good. Okay. A morning session we'll still be doing, but you're leaving after lunch?
Yeah.
Oh, what time? Sorry?
We're leaving at
1:30. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah. Because sometimes, I think last year I went to Dhammaloka to give the talk, but this year I'm staying here. Ajahn Sujata will give the talk on Friday night. Yeah, because he's someone new. Seen me so many times. You know, every joke I said. So anyway, so that's tomorrow afternoon. So tomorrow afternoon is no... Suit a class.